We return now to the Dr. Carolyn Dean live radio show, along with her host, cohort, and good buddy, Ginny Sanders. Phone lines are open during live broadcast.
Okay, so we press on with hour two. What else shall we chat about?
Well, I was trying to talk about grassroots health, and I think it's something that Taylor would be interested in because it is it's bringing sort of home testing into the clinical realm. Because what they're finding out, Taylor, is for their, you know, whatever, how many thousands of people that have a certain level of vitamin D in the blood, they're matched with the amount of vitamin D that they're taking. And everybody is so different. It's incredible. You know, someone can take 2,000 units a day and get a very high level, and their spouse or partner can be taking 10,000 and they're still low. So everybody has different requirements. Now, I'm saying, well, it could be partly their magnesium saturation that's affecting their ability to pull in their vitamin D. So this organization, grassrootshealth.org, they're establishing statistics to be able to give us answers, like pregnant women, how much vitamin D should they have in their blood tests, and how much should they be taking in order to get that level. And they've already found out that people who take over 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day, they require less supplemental vitamin D to get a sufficient clinical level of vitamin D in the blood. Now, that's never going to happen in university studies because they just keep testing one thing at a time. I mean, you were very clear about how you just have to test the magnesium to be able to make sure it's not affected by other things. So I think it's quite interesting. And it's a type of research I've been wanting to do. You know, the $1 billion that you would take for a university study or a drug study, let's say, why not set up a clinic with all our products and give people our products and measure their outcomes? I think that would give us a lot more information than doing $1 billion drug study. Oh. What do you think, Taylor?
Oh, you know, absolutely. And I tell you, it goes straight back to my point about having a National Institute for Nutrition. All of the research I'm aware of on vitamin D has been done in Caucasian populations. And we now have a show that at least African Americans metabolize vitamin D very differently. At least sun exposure. Babies still out of the bathwater, you know, whether it's that way for, ingested ingested vitamin D, excuse me. And, you know, it's just, we need that subpopulation research. And, you know, I think what you're saying is dead on. I think we should be working with, you know, clinicians like you who have access to patients that we're interested in. To measure these markers. And I think technology will take us there. I mean, you know, I won't lie, more than just our lab, you know, we're doing these types of measurements and assays these days. And that's because the technology has really enabled us to measure multiple markers on, you know, with one sample and one platform. So it's kind of like, you know, the ionized magnesium being measured in clinics is like a standard thing. Do I think it would happen if it was, you know, a machine that you had to purchase just for ionized magnesium? No, because that's a awesome clinic. But I think when a machine that measures, different markers incorporates ionized magnesium, then you'll see that it's a different story. When I was the chief science officer at the National Osteoporosis Foundation, one of the things that was not so great about Obamacare was that it cut DEXA scanning, or what most people know as bone scans. It cut the reimbursement for clinicians from about $150 to a little less than $50. And so it wasn't financially feasible to do bone scans, and therefore a lot of people didn't get diagnosed, and you saw an increase in, you know, fractures because of the lack of diagnosis. Well, you know, industry responded to that by including the technology where you can measure bone density when you go in and get your mammogram. That same, you know, type And so it was that same type of x-ray was, you were able to use that on machines that, that looked at mammograms. And so, you know, that was a solution that I think we're going to start seeing become more and more universal, machines that can measure more than just one thing. And then, you know, that's how we get around.
Multitasking, just like Jenny. So let's talk about the next part of our study. What's because it's like there are all these different arms of what you're doing with us. So what's the next study going involved? It got in the middle of the COVID, of course, so it's slowed down. But can you tell us about that?
Well, yeah, like you said, we've taken a little bit of a pause because we're not allowed to do human subjects research, you know, right now, nor would we want to, because COVID-19, you know, there's an onset of such a difference in metabolic activity in people that are affected. It would probably, you know, drastically affect the results of our study. That might be a good or bad thing. We might find a new research gap, but currently we're not allowed to run studies at the university at this time because of the pandemic. But after the pandemic is over, hopefully, you know, in the fall or at least by 2021, we'll be able to go back in. We're going to run a very similar study with REMAG. You know, we looked at REMAG versus placebo. This time we're also going to have a couple other arms of the study where we'll be looking at REMAG, which is a picometer-sized magnesium chloride, and we're going to compare that to magnesium oxide and magnesium citrate, which are two more common forms of magnesium that are sold as dietary supplements. And the difference being that these would cause a laxative effect if you had more than 300, or the chance of a laxative effect would increase if you took more than 350 milligrams. So what we're really going to do is, you know, the bioavailability, particularly of magnesium oxide, has been reported to be rather low. Citrate, on the other hand, is reported to be rather high. And so we, you know, now that REMAG has shown an effect in just a single dose, we're going to compare it to other forms of magnesium, because if you're going to spend your money and take a supplement, you might as well get the best bang for your buck. And so we're going to test that theory just to see, you know, what that is. Now, we're also separately, we're going to be doing what's called a reference range study, because when you look at, or when the doctor tells you, you know, your vitamin D levels are not normal, or, you know, something like that, that's based on, you know, us collecting blood samples from hundreds of individuals and analyzing their vitamin D levels. That currently, we currently don't have that data for ionized magnesium. So it's important to do that study, because we need to know what the current population status is, so we can define if you're low or not. And so we're undertaking both of those new studies, and we're really excited about, you know, that opportunity that you've provided us.
Right, right. Now that brings up a point, Taylor. When they measure the population that walks into the lab, in my world, 80% of them are already low. So they're coming in, 100 people get tested, they have these these values, but and they give a range, but they act like that's a normal population. That's what, you know, freaks me out. And I keep saying, if you want to know how much magnesium to take and how your blood levels will reflect a good intake, I say it has to be in the high normal.
Right.
Why would you want to be low normal when the population is so depleted? Is any allowance made for that realization?
So there's kind of two steps to the process with developing a reference range. So first you go out to the general healthy population and you get a large sample of, you know, people that we have, you know, looked at clinically, and we say, okay, you're healthy. You know, per all these, per this checklist, you know, you don't have any disease, you're physically active, you're, you know, so we take a wide range of age groups. Obviously we have just as many men as we do women. And we take blood samples from, and we look at, in this case, ionized magnesium, and we get a range. And so traditionally, like with serum magnesium, and this is how far behind some of the magnesium research is, unlike vitamin D or some of these other nutrients, serum magnesium just has that. So the reference range is basically, you know, they took the blood samples from these healthy people and they said, okay, if you're in the bottom 5%, then you're considered low. And if you're in the top 5%, you're considered high. And everything else is the normal range. Well, that's a good start, but that's not what we really want. If you look at people who are like pre-diabetic, or, you know, maybe they have heart palpitations or some time of chronic ailment or condition that's occurring, then you can say a lot of times you can tell the difference. Maybe those individuals have lower ionized magnesium. And then you can say, okay, this is the result of being magnesium deficient. And so it's important to take that first step that we're taking, where you look at what a healthy person looks like and what the healthy population looks like. But then you also want to look at people who are diseased, and you want to see if there's a difference in those levels. And, you know, if there is, then, you know, you have a more solid goal for people to, you know, achieve. And we have that with calcium and vitamin D and, you know, potassium, some of the other electrolytes, but not magnesium to date.
Right, right. Yeah, it's interesting because when I'm pretty saturated with magnesium and have no symptoms, and my blood levels are sky high. So that someone might say to me, well, you've got too much. And this we come across periodically with our customers. They say, I'm too high, maybe I should stop taking magnesium. Well, maybe too high is the new normal. So
You know, when your reference ranges and serum magnesium is like this, you know, just because you're higher, well, higher than what? The rest of the healthy population, you're in that top 5%. Is that necessarily detrimental? No, but let's go the next step. Let's start looking at people with chronic conditions. And then, you know, if you identify, you know, the level at which high magnesium is an issue, then you can begin to say with, you know, if you look at somebody who's diseased that's hypermagnesemic, you know, that's not just based on, you know, oh, here's what's in the normal population. That's based on, okay, if you go past this level, you get this type of toxicity. And, you know, all nutrients have a level to where there's toxic effects. A lot of times we haven't identified them yet. You know, what we've identified as the toxic level of magnesium is the laxative effects, which, you know, likely don't apply to REMAG. So
right.
It's about doing that science and, you know, basing our recommendations around solid evidence versus trying to take a guess.
Well, you know what I call the laxative effect with magnesium? It's a fail-safe. It's the only nutrient I know that if there's too much, the body dumps it. And therefore, you really rarely, I don't know if I've ever heard of anyone getting a toxic level of magnesium to cause heart palpitations, except when they're by mistake, by medical error, given too much intravenous magnesium in hospitals. Or I've heard of it with the magnesium sulfate in eclampsia in patients who have some sort of reaction to the sulfate part of magnesium or to the preservative in the magnesium. So I call it a fail-safe. I don't know. You've read my book, but just to remind the listeners, I think that magnesium developed as fail-safe because in our ancestry, living by the ocean, where ocean seaweeds and fish and all has three times the magnesium as it does calcium, because they're in seawater, there's three times magnesium compared to calcium. So that we selected certain mechanisms to hold on to our calcium, which is vitamin D from the sun, so that we could get enough calcium to balance off this extra magnesium. But now, where we're in a society that is supplementing calcium, fortifying with calcium, eating lots of dairy at the same time as not having magnesium in the soil, so it's not in our diet, we've gone the opposite way. And then we've got this culture now with the high-dose vitamin D where they think it can be a cure-all, and we're getting problems because people aren't taking enough magnesium. And there's so many gaps in our nutrition knowledge, like you were saying.
Well, and, you know, I'll say a couple of things. One, like with magnesium, calcium, and phosphorus, and some of your other minerals, your body does know when to cut off. One of my arguments a few years ago, again, when I was at the National Osteoporosis Foundation, is Bayer, the company, had come out with a 1200 milligram calcium product. And I was just kind of like, okay, well, that's not right, because your body will only absorb a maximum of 500 to 600 milligrams at a time. So you have a lot of postmenopausal women that think, oh, I can just take my calcium supplement once a day and, you know, I'm okay. But you excrete, you know, a majority of that calcium because your body does in many aspects, you know, have a cutoff of it. And then you have, you know, these different nutrients, magnesium and calcium being two of them, that compete for absorption. So if you're taking a magnesium supplement and a calcium supplement, they'll most certainly compete. Now, REMAG is absorbed in a different way than, you know, most magnesium supplements, or at least we think it is. So that might not necessarily be the case there. But traditionally, iron, zinc, calcium, magnesium, a lot of those minerals compete for absorption, and the body does cut it off at a certain point. It just goes to say, you know, again, that we really, really need good research in this field. And, you know, it also, I think, stems from, you know, there's a lot of voices out there. It's every time I read Journal of the American Medical Association, I almost cringe, because I just know every nutrition thing in there isn't going to work. And it's usually because somebody didn't study it correctly. They didn't control a study like what we did in ours. They didn't, look at synergies between nutrients. You really have to have an in-depth understanding of that biochemistry before you get into the lab. Or else you have a high risk of, you know, your study going completely null because you haven't controlled for the right things.
Right. Well, with the calcium, what I started observing in the literature was all this 1200 milligram supplement of calcium, and the more the better. It causes constipation. It deposits in soft tissues. It started to calcify people. It was depositing in arteries and even in DCIS, the ductal carcinoma in situ. It was causing a lot of problems, and it probably still is. In your work with the Osteoporosis Foundation, I presume that's with Dr. Connie Weaver, who was also on our study. She's a famous calcium researcher. Did you study or go into the calcification aspects of calcium supplementation?
Well, yeah, and you know, there's you know, like with any mineral, there is a high portion, you know, at least 10% or more of older adults who start developing impaired kidney function due to one thing or another. And when that happens, the body doesn't handle minerals like calcium and phosphorus very well. Even magnesium sometimes isn't handled well by people with CKD, with really impaired renal function. And what happens, it starts building up in your soft tissues, which are, you know, your arteries mainly. And that can, you know, potentially lead to, you know, vascular complications. Now, again, the issue, you know, when people ask me, do calcium supplements cause, you know, heart attacks or vascular calcification? And my answer is usually no. Chronic kidney disease causes that. But also, you know, remember these nutrients, like we just talked about, they all, you know, interplay together. And so it's not necessarily about how much can I get. It's about having the right balance, because, you know, that balance of calcium and magnesium is important in regard to blood pressure. That balance between magnesium, sodium, and potassium is really important. And so all things, you know, our body's very interconnected. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons, you know, you see in a lot of these medical journals, and we do a lot of systematic reviews, so I probably shouldn't knock them too hard, but it doesn't really fully elucidate the biochemistry behind things and how these nutrients interact with each other. And I think that's missing. And from a personalized nutrition approach, like you said earlier, everybody's levels are different. Everybody needs a different amount. We can take a good guess. And we try to make policy recommendations and communications that are simple for people to understand. But it's a very, very complex process in the body.
Right, right. Yes, that's interesting about the kidneys. And I would say, yes, if you don't have enough magnesium and you have too much calcium, then the calcium going through your kidneys can actually calcify the kidneys. I mean, you get calcium kidney stones, and you need the magnesium to solubilize the calcium. And that's another thing that's ignored. I mean, you have such a tough battle, Taylor, in your work with nutrition, because doctors don't learn anything about nutrition. It's just not on the books.
And, you know, I really have to hand it to the American Society for Nutrition, because they have really been active in pushing intro to nutrition in medical school curricula. And I think that's super important, because, you know, I've seen survey after survey after survey where we ask, you know, where do doctors get their information about nutrition? And it's sadly the same place that consumers get their information about nutrition. It's TV, it's radio programs, it's, you know, infomercials and, you know, the newspaper and things like that. And so there's a lot of conflicting and confusing information, because a new study comes out every day, but that doesn't mean that a new study is representative of the whole body of evidence. And that doesn't mean that new study, you know, really puts all the pieces of biochemistry that we know together. So we also know from these same surveys that consumers say their number one resource for nutrition information is their physician, their doctor.
Oh, my. Right. Yeah, let's find out how Ginny's doing and see if she has any questions for you.
Denise, doing wonderfully and enjoying the robust conversation, and I know this is important to so many people who listen to our show, everything that we've talked about tonight. So we're all doing, mm-hmm. I'm doing great, doing great.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Now, I mentioned Dr. Connie Weaver and her work with calcium, but in the midst of our work and meeting Connie and, you know, having our dinners together and all, she was saying that her funding for her calcium research suddenly dried up. Tell us about where do you get your funding? I know you've already said you've come to depend on industry, which is folks like us, and the government isn't putting any money out. I mean, how is that going to be improved? Where can you get more funding?
Well, so Connie actually for years, and Connie Weaver is just the most lovely person and has always been a dear friend and mentor of mine. She is also one of those very, 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 very few people that have gotten an NIH grant to research nutrition. And she actually basically our reference intakes, what our government says, when you look at the food label and you see how much calcium that you have. Connie defined those reference intakes for adolescents, for teenagers. And she did that through several years of a summer camp she hosted that was funded by NIH that was called Camp Calcium. And it was very similar, actually, to our study, except it was, you know, probably $6 million a year. she brought in, a few dozen kids to summer camp, and she completely controlled their diet. She controlled, like, the amount of time they had outside, that they exercised, their activities, their everything. And from that, she was able to determine the calcium requirement for developing bone. And so when you look at, all of the, commercials for, getting enough bone or getting enough calcium to make strong bones in kids and adolescents, Connie did all that work. I mean, she's definitely a pioneer in the field. I mean, I always used to tell the people at the National Osteoporosis Foundation, if Jesus Christ came down to earth and said one thing about calcium and Connie said the other, I would be like, I think I'm going to go with her. she's brilliant.
Oh, that's very cool. Yes, she's a sweetheart. That's wonderful. And then one of the other researchers, Nana, while we were working with y'all, she got, what was the grant she got or the award? Gosh, it slipped my mind.
Yeah, so she actually got a Fulbright Award. Fulbright was set up in after World War II by Senator Fulbright to encourage collaboration among nations. And so the thought was, you have all these emerging nations and, the goal is if you have exchange, so in this case, Dr. Gletsu Miller is in Ireland doing a sabbatical and studying, most of the Fulbright grants actually allow international students to come into the U.S. to get an advanced degree. And then afterwards, the hope is that they will take their knowledge back to a developing country and really help grow that country's GDP. And, it's an investment in their innovation and science development. And so it's a great program. I actually went to a graduate school with a couple Fulbright scholars from places like Ecuador and Peru. I think it's really helped, internationally, for the development of, countries that are middle to lower income.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's awesome. And there were students on the study as well. I know we met the technician. I don't think we met the other students, but where the paper came out, it ends up, there's about 6 or 8 people on our paper. It was quite fascinating how many people were involved. Is that usually the case? You said earlier something about, well, the student did a test and of our picometer size, and you decide to repeat it. So do students run a lot of the studies under guidance?
Yes and no. It depends on what part of the study. So, you know, if you take a controlled feeding study like ours, you have to have a dietitian that prepares the individual meals that have the right nutrient ratios, because you don't want to give food that's high in magnesium when you're, you know, doing a magnesium trial of a supplement. So you have to have the people that prepare the food. You have to have the phlebotomist that takes the blood. You have to have the people who are the technicians that calibrate the equipment every day to make sure that they're running correctly and that they're doing that the measurement is the same from day to day. You have to have people who are planning and executing the study, like Dr. Gletsu Miller and myself. You have to have statisticians who come in and look at all of the different variables in the study, and you try to correct for anything that might be confounding. And you have to ensure you have strong statistical analysis. So, you know, in a good study, there are, you know, lots of individuals on that study, even in a small study like ours. And that's a good thing, because you get so many different perspectives and ideas that you're more likely to not miss something, or at least in my
opinion. Right. So what's your wish list for how you want to proceed, either with us or with magnesium or with the NIH? What would you like to see? Because I know when we sat down and Nana was saying she wanted to do studies on magnesium and diabetes, what's your wish list, Taylor?
Well, first, I want COVID-19 to go away so we can finish your trial as well as the other, you know, okay, 7 trials that I have going on that got, you know, cut right in the middle. And so, you know, I want to finish that work. I want to finish the reference range work of the healthy population. And then I want to go into chronic disease. I want to start looking at individuals, and I think, you know, type 2 diabetes is a good one. I think heart disease is another, issue that's, and blood pressure that is, they're good markers of if you might be insufficient or deficient in magnesium. And I want to try to create a reference range there. I also want to do a randomized control trial once we identify which disease states are likely most influenced by magnesium, and we get that reference range complete. I want to start, you know, I would love to do a large randomized control trial with REMAG, and look at, you know, a dose response. And what that means is we would give multiple doses. So, you know, one day you might get one dose, or you could be getting 2 doses or 3 doses or the placebo. And what that does allows us to see, you know, if what the appropriate amount of magnesium to supplement with. So, you know, if one dose shows something, then maybe 2 doses shows an even better effect, and then maybe 3 doses, and then maybe 20 doses is too much. And I think that's important for developing reference intakes within our federal government. One of the things people don't realize is that our federal government a few years ago prioritized magnesium as one of the nutrients that the reference intakes need to be updated. And our friends Andrea Rosenoff and Becky Costello at the Center for Magnesium Education and Research were pivotal in getting the data to where out of these 40 or so nutrients, that magnesium was selected as one of the top 4. And now that sodium and potassium have been done, vitamin E, omega-3s, and magnesium are prioritized next. So I think this work that we're doing and future work, the more we can do, soon, the better off that these new reference intakes will be informed by evidence.
Very good. So, yes, I didn't realize we were right up there in line for this reference ranging that will highlight that. And now that you know how important the absorption is and how REMAG is absorbed, we'll be getting to the point where REMAG will be the sine qua non, whatever that means. It will be the top enchilada.
Right.
Very good.
I think our second study where we look at magnesium and oxide and magnesium citrate is going to be really exciting, because I really think that we're onto something with REMAG. And I think, like I said, that it's not only, this research isn't just good for the REMAG product. It's good for the world because we're advancing what we know about magnesium and our requirement for magnesium. And this research has long been due.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Ginny, over to you. Do you have a question? I mean, we're coming down to the final 10 minutes. I can't believe we've been at this for 2 hours. Thank you so much, Taylor. Are there things you want to say? What have we left out?
Oh, gosh. Time just flies by when I talk to you. I didn't even realize we were up to 2 hours.
You're so sweet.
Well, yeah. I just think that, for the people that have listened in for 2 hours, I think that this field is so exciting and so emerging, rapidly emerging, it's changing by the day. And, one of the things I will say that is a good thing, or at least in my opinion, that has come out of COVID-19, we've always been, at least as scientists, a little bit scared of supplements. And I think that's really going to change after this whole pandemic, because I think we're starting to see more and more, particularly with vitamin D, but also with other nutrients like magnesium, that supplements can really change the game when it comes to health, particularly with this type of an infection. And I think that's going to make people a lot more open to using dietary supplements to fill the gap. I mean, and it's practical. Like you said, the soil's been depleting for some time now. Magnesium levels and intake aren't what they used to be. And we know that. Mm-hmm. You see the same thing with potassium. One of Dr. Weaver's new studies that just published in Journal of American College of Nutrition showed that blood potassium levels were decreasing. From 1999 to 2016, it was gradually decreasing, and it's the same story of potassium as it is magnesium. And, from a sustainability standpoint, we're really going to have to learn how to sustain, soon to be 9 billion people on this planet. And I think, supplements are, going to be a practical option for many people. And I think that nutrition science is moving forward. I think more and more people are recognizing its importance. I think consumers are becoming more educated on the science that is out there. I think in a lot of instances, technology is wonderful because it's enabled us to communicate directly with each other at a much faster pace. At the same time, it's also enabled a lot of misinformation to be out there. And so, I see that as an opportunity, but also as a big challenge. And, like I said, I think the most important thing we can do as Americans is establish a National Institute for Nutrition within NIH, where there is mandated federal funds. Our dietary guidelines, we publish dietary guidelines, we update them every 5 years. And every 5 years, there's a committee of 20 of the most prominent nutrition scientists. One of my dearest friends, Reagan Bailey, is on the current committee. Connie's been on, of course, past committees. And every 5 years, that committee leaves behind questions where there wasn't enough research to give to make public recommendations around. And those questions never get answered because there's no government funding for nutrition. And so I really do think, you know, as a nation, we have to get it together when it comes to prevention research, and we have to fix the system, not just for magnesium, but for all of the nutrients that our body needs. And if we want to combat disease, then we've really got to start investing in prevention.
Well, one thing I'll say, go ahead, Carolyn.
No, your turn, hon.
I was just going to say one thing I'll say that Carolyn probably won't say, Taylor, because she doesn't brag the way I do on her. But, you know, our cohort of customers is usually 45 plus, and a lot of them are 65 plus, and many of them are in their 80s, and they're committed to having a quality lifestyle, and they're using our products, and they're using them in a way that Carolyn recommends. We took a survey of our entire customer population from around the world, and we only had one customer that had the flu, the COVID flu. And that's really a testimony to what you're talking about. Proper supplementation, directed by doctor recommended, doctor supported, clinically, you know, research and validated, and then in a preventative manner, so that when your body does, it is presented with a challenge like this pandemic, you can rise to the occasion.
Absolutely. And, you know, you just actually sparked a new research question in my head, and we'll have to talk offline. But I have a master's student that I'm working with. She's just doing some very simple survey research, but she's more into the psychology behind why people take dietary supplements. And she's been relatively interested in magnesium with all the work that Nana or Dr. Gletzi Miller and myself have been doing lately. One of the criticisms about dietary supplements is that healthy people take supplements. So it might not be the supplement, it's just the healthy lifestyle is usually what takes a supplement. It would be really interesting to go back in and look at your customers and see the psychology behind why they are taking magnesium. And I think you'll see, you know, from, or at least from what I've seen, a very different story than what's in a lot of the peer-reviewed journals right now.
Yes, absolutely.
Right, because our customers are sick.
Yeah.
They are sick, sick, sick. I'm sorry, customer listeners, but you know about Total Body Meltdown. And seriously, most people come to us, Taylor, on a half a dozen medications, and they're looking for answers. And it sort of dances around the COVID business because they see that nobody has the answer for COVID. So they do look for supplements, or they look to supplements, and we're working now with certainly our REMAG and our Apico Zinc, because hydroxychloroquine, it works to open up cell mineral ion channels to allow zinc into the cells. Zinc has a hard time getting into cells, but once it's in there, it starts beating up on the virus particles. And what our PicoZinc does, as you know, with the absorption, it's at a size that will just slip right into the cells and go to work. And we're working with the vitamin D3 K2 product, and we have a whole C vitamin C. And what we're finding already, and it'll become quite evident to our people, if they start taking these immune supplements, they're going to have so many other benefits: skin, hair, nails, even longevity, even wrinkles, even just the energy. Everything is going to be enhanced because they're taking nutrients which are such high quality and so well absorbed, they don't need high doses. I mean, I've been through the decades of supplementation where if a certain amount of a vitamin or mineral didn't work, the doctor just kept giving more and more and more without realizing it had to be better absorbed, not just higher amounts. So yes, we're learning a lot from COVID, and we're learning a lot from our customers. And we will we'll talk to you about that potential research where we can survey our people to see what their experience is.
Yeah,
I'll let Ginny take over. Well, go ahead, because we just have a minute or two, Taylor, but you finish up.
Oh, no, I was just going to say it would be really interesting to look at some of the COVID patients versus people who didn't contract COVID versus asymptomatic people, you know, and really look at some of these nutrients because, you know, like you said, they play with each other. They're synergistic. They don't act in isolation. They're partners in crime. And so I think it'd be really, I think COVID's going to open up everybody's eyes when it comes to nutrition.
Very good. Yes.
Very good.
It should be a gift. It's a big enough price. It should be a gift for all of us for sure. Absolutely. There should be a powering interpretation for all of this. Taylor, it's been such a blessing to have you. We're so grateful that you were with us in our flagship launch on Dream Vision 7. Sorry about the little technical glitch earlier, but it all redeemed itself. And once again, you're just such a delight, and we just love, love, love you.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. And I love, love, love you all as well. So I could sit on here for another hour and talk to you. But it's been great discussing this. And I'm so excited for the future of REMAG and magnesium.
Thank you,
perfect,
sweetheart.
Perfect
thank
word.
You.
Big hugs. Thank you.
Big hugs.
Okay, we're out in a second. Thank you, Ginny. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, listeners. And thank you, Taylor. Great show.
Listening to the Dr. Carolyn Dean Live Radio Show. For questions about today's broadcast, email Dr. Dean at questions@drcarolyndeanlive.com. That's questions@drcarolyndeanlive.com.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.